This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me the great investigative reporter Jeremy Scahill. You may have read his stuff in The Nation. He's the author of an incredible new book called Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy Scahill, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's great to be with you, Matt.
Tell me how you got on the story in the first place.
I think I first heard about Blackwater USA the way that most people did, not just in this country but in the world. And that was on March 31st, 2004, when four Blackwater private soldiers were ambushed and killed in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. It was a famous, iconic moment of the Iraq War. An Iraqi mob descended on the men after they'd been shot and killed by resistance fighters and tore them apart limb by limb, dragged their bodies through the streets, and then hung them from a bridge stretching over the Euphrates River. And the Bush administration, of course, famously laid siege to Fallujah, killed hundreds of civilians inside the city, displaced thousands upon thousands of others. And it really was the week that the war turned and that the Iraqi resistance exploded. And having been to Fallujah many times myself, I watched with utter horror as the city was destroyed.
Well, how did it happen that you'd been to Fallujah many times before?
I started going to Iraq in 1998. I went in with an early delegation of the Chicago-based Voices in the Wilderness, the campaign to end the U.S.-led economic sanctions against Iraq, and went into the country in the weeks leading up to the Clinton administration's attack on Iraq in December of 1998. And it was the first of well over a dozen trips that I would end up taking to Iraq.
Now, were you there as a witness or a reporter or both?
No, I was there as a reporter for Pacifica Radio. I just started working for Pacifica Radio and got this invitation to accompany this group of activists and report on their delegation to the country. And they were going there. This was before we really had the term human shields in the, you know, in the discourse as we did during the lead up to the Iraq invasion. And at the time, they truly were voices in the wilderness. It was very rare for an American journalist to go into Iraq and spend any sort of time there. And we traveled the country and I did a lot of reporting on the sanctions, spent a lot of time in Iraqi hospitals. And, you know, in the summer of 2002, I actually camped out in the Iraqi desert right near Fallujah. So I had been there a number of times before that. So I knew the city well. And I also knew that the media coverage of Fallujah, this idea that it was somehow Saddam Hussein's hotbed and was this place that had prospered under his regime, was a total fallacy.
Why was that wrong?
Well, on the one hand, it's a Sunni city, and it definitely was home to many members of the Republican Guard. On the other hand, it was a very poor city. It was a strict religious city that had suffered tremendously under the sanctions. It also, the people of Fallujah, unlike those of Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, didn't live with any sort of great shakes in life. They suffered. There was a shortage of food supplies inside the city regularly, medical supplies. They suffered like the rest of the country. This was hardly a hotbed of pro-Saddam resistance. And the evidence of that emerged after Saddam's regime was overthrown by the U.S. invasion. The people of Fallujah overthrew the local government and actually began building in place a replacement for it. And there was some semblance of input from a wide variety of people in Fallujah in building a sort of new running of the city. And the U.S. came in and wiped that out.
I read in your book that at a protest there were signs that said, down with Saddam, down with the U.S.
Exactly. And that happened at there was a major incident that happened in April of 2003 when the U.S. forces actually took Fallujah. You see, when U.S. tanks first rolled into Baghdad, people in Fallujah didn't come face to face with U.S. military. The military had sort of stayed on the outskirts of the city. And that's when people started to organize themselves inside of the city. And then the U.S. forces sort of came in and began to negotiate and say, we want to come inside the city to protect you. The people of Fallujah said, we don't need you. Then the 82nd Airborne ended up coming in by force, taking over a primary school. And people had been sending their kids to school, trying to keep some semblance of normalcy alive for children. And so the U.S. forces came in, displaced the school, took it over. The Iraqis in late April 2003 in Fallujah organized a protest, and it ended in essentially a firefight in which many Fallujans were killed by U.S. forces, and people would go in to try to retrieve the wounded, and they would be sniped. And this was well documented by Human Rights Watch and international journalists. And that really set the people of Fallujah on a collision course with the occupation forces and ultimately with Blackwater mercenaries.
So that was, in a sense, Jeremy Scahill, the backstory to the killing of these Blackwater mercenaries. When you heard about the story, did you decide to drop everything and follow it, or
no.
What happened?
No, I mean, I think that like a lot of other journalists, I just was paying attention now to the reality that there were heavily armed private soldiers operating in Iraq and elsewhere in the so-called war on terror. And I didn't begin any sort of in-depth investigation of Blackwater USA. I had no idea of the political connections of the company. It was just on my radar. When I decided that it was a story that I was going to drop everything and follow was when I went to New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in September of 2005. I'll never forget it. I'm standing on a street corner on Bourbon Street in the French Quarter talking to two New York City police officers. I live in New York, and I thought it was interesting that they were there. We were just kind of chatting, and this unmarked compact car pulls up, and there's, I can't remember if it was three or four, but there's these guys in it who are, you know, just strapped with ammunition, wielding M4 machine guns, Glock 9 pistols strapped to their legs. They get out of the car, and they come up to the cops, and they say, "Where are the rest of the Blackwater guys?" And the police say, "Oh, they're down the street. There's a bunch of them." And they get back into their car, and they zoom off, no license plates on the car. And I said to the police, "Blackwater, you mean like the guys in Iraq?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, they're all over the place here." So I went and hunted them down and found a couple of them and ended up talking to them for about an hour and a half. And I, you know, I asked some questions I think any journalist would have. I said, "You know, what are you guys doing here?" And they said, "Well, we came in to help." And I said, "Well, what's your mission here?" And they said, "We're here to confront criminals and stop looters." And I said, "Under whose authority are you here? Did the government hire you?" And they kind of fumbled around with each other for an answer. And one guy reaches into his bulletproof vest and pulls out a gold law enforcement badge. And he says, "I was deputized by the governor of the state of Louisiana." And then another guy said, "Well, we're actually sleeping in a camp organized by the Department of Homeland Security." And I said, "So are you on state or federal contract?" And they said, "Oh, you'd have to talk to higher ups for that." And in fact, the Department of Homeland Security denied that the administration had hired any private forces. But in fact, Blackwater had been hired by the Department of Homeland Security Federal Protective Service. And you know, Matt, it's interesting. The guys on the ground there were complaining that there wasn't enough action in New Orleans. They wanted to get back to Iraq. Several of them had been bodyguards for Paul Bremer or John Negroponte. And they said they were making $350 per day, per man, to be in the hurricane zone. When I ended up, through the Freedom of Information Act, getting the Blackwater contract, it turns out Blackwater was billing the federal government $950 per man per day, raking in $240,000 a day.
So they were getting a little $600 cut above everything.
Sure.
Tell me how this company was formed. I was astonished to read how fresh it is, how new it just kind of came fully blown out of the ground in North Carolina just 10 years ago.
Right. Yeah. A decade ago, it basically didn't exist. And today it's, I call it the Praetorian Guard for the War on Terror, the elite private guard of the War on Terror. It's a company that was founded by a guy named Eric Prince, and his story is fascinating. He comes from, not far from Wisconsin. He's from the state of Michigan, from a town called Holland, Michigan. And his dad was a real pull yourself up by your bootstraps capitalist, a self-made man. He ran a company called Prince Manufacturing. And the company existed from the 70s into the mid-90s, and they serviced the auto industry in Michigan. And perhaps the best-known invention of the company is the now ubiquitous lighted sun visor. When you're driving around your car, you pull down your visor, it lights up. That's the Prince family. But more important than watching his dad build up this successful business, Eric Prince watched as his father used the business as a cash-generating engine to support the rise of what we now know as the religious right, as well as the Republican Revolution of 94. His dad gave the seed money to Gary Bauer to found the Family Research Council, gave him $400,000. Eric Prince, the eventual founder of Blackwater, was one of the first interns at the Family Research Council. They gave substantial funding to James Dobson and his focus on the family prayer warrior networks. Eric Prince's sister, Betsy, married Dick DeVos, the heir to the Amway Corporation fortune, the owners of the Orlando Magic basketball team, and the single greatest bankrollers of the Republican Revolution of 94. So these two families, the DeVoses and the Princes, merged together in a kind of relationship that existed in the monarchies of old Europe. And so all through the 80s and 90s, young Eric Prince is around all of these people that would become primary players in our current politics today. He interned in George H.W. Bush's White House, but complained it wasn't conservative enough for him. Then he goes over and he interns with Dana Rohrabacher, a Republican congressman from California, former Reagan speechwriter, a guy who, before he started serving his congressional term, goes over to Afghanistan to fight alongside the Mujahideen. So this is young Eric Prince's sort of growing up with these people who would go on to be sort of infamous infamous or famous Christian conservatives or Republican power players.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. My guest today, Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. You may have read his dispatches in The Nation or heard him on Democracy Now! Eric did not then take over the family business, though.
No, his dad died in 1995 of a heart attack. And Eric Prince is believed to be one of the wealthiest people ever to have joined the U.S. Navy SEALs, widely believed to be the most elite force in the U.S. military. He's in the SEALs in the early 90s. He goes to Bosnia, Haiti. He's in the Mediterranean. When his dad dies and his wife has cancer, he goes back to Michigan to help the family sift through what they're going to do. And they end up selling the business for about $1.4 billion in cash to Johnson Controls. And Eric took his share of the family fortune, left the Navy SEALs, got together with a bunch of his other special operations buddies, and opens up what was envisioned as a sportsman's paradise and training center for federal and local law enforcement based on the Great Dismal Swamp of North Carolina. And the early company literature, they incorporated it in 1996. Its original name was Blackwater Lodge and Training.
I mean, it was a shooting range, essentially.
Right. It was an outdoor shooting range, a sportsman's paradise. And but one of their visions was anticipating accelerated government outsourcing of training. And so basically from 1996 until 9/11, Blackwater benefited from almost annual tragedies. In 1999, the Columbine incident happened, you know, widely referred to as the Columbine Massacre. Well, Blackwater's response to that was to build a mock high school on their 5,000-acre compound called Are You Ready High? And they invited law enforcement agents from around the country to come and train in how to deal with high school violence. Then the next year in 2000, the USS Cole was bombed off the coast of Yemen. Blackwater got its first major contract with the military, $35 million from the Navy to train sailors in how to defend ships and vessels from those kinds of attacks. But when 9/11 happened, the gloves came off and Blackwater became a mercenary army.
And they even exploited the tragedy of Fallujah. How did they do that?
Right. After 9/11, Blackwater's founder, Eric Prince, was on the Fox News with talking to Bill O'Reilly. To my knowledge, the only TV interview he's ever done. And he was on to talk about the federal air marshal system and arming air marshals and training them. And he said, you know, I was starting to get a little cynical about how seriously people took security and training. But after 9/11, the phone's been ringing off the hook. And one of the calls that came into Blackwater after 9/11 was from the Central Intelligence Agency. And they authorized a black contract for Blackwater to send operatives into Afghanistan in the early stages of the aftermath of 9/11. That began Blackwater's work for the government providing private soldiers. Go ahead.
No, go on. Just, so they've been in tight with the CIA from the very beginning was the thought that crossed my mind. And I see later on that they get Kofor Black, who was the big counterterrorism guy at the CIA, to join the company.
Right. He's now the vice chairman of the company, and he was the man who led the hunt for bin Laden. He was the head of the counterterrorism center at the CIA on 9/11, the man who told Bush that he would bring bin Laden's head back in a box with dry ice. And in fact, his nickname in the administration was the flies on the eyeball guy, because he told the Bush administration, we're going to have flies crawling across the eyeballs of the Taliban when we're through with them in Afghanistan. We're going to put their heads on pikes. I mean, he would talk in those sort of terms, and his colleagues describe him as sort of coming out with a missionary sort of vision of things under the war on terror. So he's just one of many of these officials that now pepper the landscape at Blackwater. But really, Blackwater's moment arrived when Paul Bremer hit the ground in Baghdad, Bush's original viceroy, the proconsul, as he was called. Blackwater got a $21 million no-bid contract to provide bodyguards for Paul Bremer and helicopters and armored vehicles.
See, this is when I started to pay attention to Blackwater. I mean, obviously, I saw the four mercenaries there killed and dismembered and hanged on the bridge there. But the fact that the U.S. ambassador or the viceroy of Iraq would not have U.S. military guys protecting him was astonishing to me. Still is, really.
You know, but check this out, Matt. I think there's a deep reason why Paul Bremer in particular wanted to be guarded by these private forces. It's the ultimate dedication to free market economics. You see, if the U.S. military was guarding Paul Bremer and he gets killed, maybe there'd be an investigation. Perhaps there'd be a court-martial if someone was found at fault for it. But they wouldn't really have gone anywhere. If a private company loses Paul Bremer, they're wiped out of business. You see, Blackwater has used the fact that they keep alive the most hated men in the most violent countries on earth as a marketing tool to win other contracts. And in fact, when the Fallujah ambush happened, Blackwater hired one of the most powerful K Street lobbying firms, the Alexander Strategy Group. It was an outfit set up by former senior staffers of then House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. It also was once employed Jack Abramoff, who's infamously discredited and disgraced Uber lobbyist. And so they hire Alexander Strategy Group. Within a week, Eric Prince and other Blackwater executives were sitting down with the men who literally ran Congress. By June of 2004, Blackwater was awarded one of the most lucrative federal contracts for Iraq. They were contracted for $320 million to provide diplomatic security for U.S. officials and friendly foreign officials. My most recent FOIA requests have generated the following fact. Blackwater has been paid $750 million, $750 million, just by the State Department alone for its work in Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's a pretty penny.
We call it making a killing off the killings.
Yeah, and the amazing thing, one of the amazing things is that, you know, right after they lost their employees in Fallujah, days later he's there in Washington hustling more contracts. Have you talked to some of the family members there?
Oh yeah.
And what was that like?
Well, I've gotten to know the families of those four men very, you know, in a very personal way over the year plus of doing this book. And one of the mothers, Katie Halvinston, has just been a remarkably strong person. And because, you know, these guys weren't in the active duty military at the time of their deaths. They all were veterans of special forces. But, you know, there was no flag-draped coffin. There was no official military funeral.
Though they did have a memorial at Blackwater
right. It's interesting. I mean, this is how the story went down. These four guys, you know, all of them were believers in the war on terror. They thought they were going to be going over there to guard Paul Bremer. They had no idea that they were going to be dying for, you know, empty trucks going to pick up pots and pans in the service of a private catering company. And their families thought that, too. The fact that they worked for Blackwater instead of being in the Navy SEALs was like of no consequence to these families. They were doing what they always did. They were serving their country. And so when they died, I don't think any of the families assumed malice on the part of Blackwater. And they did what any mother or widow would do. They started calling and saying, what happened? What were they doing in Fallujah? Why weren't they in armored vehicles? What's this I hear about kitchen equipment? And they say that Blackwater wasn't providing them with any sort of answers. And so after months of questioning, Blackwater flies all these families out to the compound in Moyock, North Carolina. In October of 2004, they're going to have this memorial service and give a chance for the families to ask some questions. So the families all describe it as sort of an Orwellian scene. They say that a Blackwater minder was assigned to each of them, that if they started to talk about the details of the ambush, the Blackwater officials would change the subject and try to get them to go see the latest toys on the compound there, this sophisticated private military base. Anyway, they go into a closed-door meeting, and one of the mothers, Donna Zavko, whose son Jerry was killed in that ambush, says that she asked Blackwater representatives to see a copy of the incident report on the ambush. And she says that the Blackwater representative stood up and angrily said, that's a classified document and you'll have to sue us to get it. And so sue they did. In January of 2005, these four families filed a groundbreaking wrongful death lawsuit against Blackwater, saying that the company had sent their men into the most dangerous city in the world in unarmored vehicles, short two men, and without heavy weaponry.
Jeremy Scahill is the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. Where does the suit stand right now, Jeremy?
Well, Blackwater enlisted the top powerhouse Republican lawyers in the country to defend against this case. The original lawyer on the case was Fred Fielding, who is currently Bush's White House counsel. It's a revolving door. He goes from being White House counsel to Blackwater's lawyer to White House counsel. They've had Greenberg Traurig, another powerful Abramoff-connected law firm. The current counsel of record for Blackwater is none other than Kenneth Starr, the man who led the impeachment charge against President Clinton. Blackwater, interestingly, hasn't disputed any of the allegations specifically, though I'm sure they will when it ends up at trial. Instead, they've tried to have the case thrown out on grounds that because Donald Rumsfeld said that the company, that the Blackwater and other war contractors constitute an official part of the U.S. total force, the U.S. war machine, they should be entitled to the same immunity from civilian litigation that the military enjoys. At the same time, Blackwater has been leading a lobbying effort to prevent the military from applying the Uniform Code of Military Justice to its forces. So that's why I say that the company has effectively declared itself above the law. Blackwater twice has appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court because the case was brought in state court in North Carolina. The Bush-backed Supreme Court has twice rejected Blackwater's appeal, and now the scene is set for the case to proceed in a sort of John Grisham-esque type atmosphere in state court in North Carolina, where there will be no cap on damages. Some are saying this could be like the tobacco litigation of the 90s.
Jeremy Scahill, it is incredible, though. You mentioned Donald Rumsfeld. officially in one of the Defense Department's annual reviews, saying now that contractors, private contractors, mercenaries, if you will, are really part of the force strategy of the U.S. government. And you have a line in the book that says Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Blackwater.
Right. I mean, and I think that Blackwater not only envisions itself as a sort of fifth branch of the military, but in some ways, I think a force greater. Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, says that he sees his company as the FedEx of the national security apparatus. And he says, if you really want a package to get somewhere, do you send it through the post office or do you send it through FedEx? And so he's proposed a contractor brigade that could supplement the work of the active duty U.S. military, because Blackwater doesn't just deal in grunts. Blackwater deals in elite special forces guys, and they package them in a very expensive way to the federal taxpayers. And they say that we're more efficient. We don't have a bloated bureaucracy. We can get the job done. And so this is the sort of rhetoric that only could come out of the mouth of a man who has a private army. Blackwater has 20,000 contractors at the ready to go to be deployed anywhere. They want to go to Darfur. They want to be deployed as peacekeepers, anti-genocide force, any way that they can spin it. They want to get those contracts.
I mean, there's layers of troublesomeness here and unaccountability here. On the one hand, they seem like they're a private CIA that's doing work for the Pentagon or the CIA and off the books, as it were, not paid by the taxpayers. On the other hand, they could be going working for anybody around the world.
Right. And in fact, one of the most disturbing trends is Blackwater recently announced the formation of a private intelligence company that's going to be headed by Kofor Black. And this intelligence company is marketing its services to private corporations, Fortune 500 companies, foreign governments in some cases. So you have the reality where you've got many senior ex-CIA officials, not just Kofor Black, Robert Richer, who was the deputy director of operations at the CIA until very recently. These guys are now privatizing their decades of CIA experience, their network of contacts, their knowledge of dirty tricks and covert operations now is being marketed essentially to the highest bidder. This is a very disturbing trend in this whole privatization scheme. And the fact is, Matt, in Iraq right now, there are 130,000 plus active duty U.S. forces. In March, Peter Pace, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, announced that there are 126,000 contractors. That effectively doubles the occupation force. And yet that half that comes from the private sector are not accountable. There's no oversight and there's no effective laws that govern them. So the Bush administration is waging a shadow war within the context of an already illegal war.
And is there reason to believe that they are more lawless than U.S. forces there?
I think that we can look at the fact that the only people that have been court-martialed for any abuses in Iraq are for the most part low-ranking soldiers, people like Lindy England and Charles Grainer. The contractors who we know were present at Abu Ghraib haven't been prosecuted for any crimes. And part of the reason is there's no effective system to prosecute them.
And one of the reasons you cite in your book, Jeremy Scale, who's the author of Blackwater, is that Paul Bremer on his way out the door gave these guys a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Right. When he skulked out of Baghdad in June of 2004, he issued an edict known as Order 17, and that effectively immunized all contractors from prosecution in Iraqi courts. And so you have a situation where the Iraqis aren't allowed to prosecute them under the U.S. occupation. The U.S. won't prosecute them, and Congress hasn't passed any effective laws to prosecute them. And the lobbyists for the mercenaries try to prevent the court-martial system from applying to them. So it truly is a Wild West-type atmosphere. I mean, in fact, the Times of London said that in post-invasion Iraq, the big market is not oil, it's private security.
Well, has Congress attempted to do anything about regulating Blackwater and other of these mercenary companies? I believe it's against the law. The Posse Comitatus Act says you cannot raise private armies on U.S. soil. There is an interesting telling account encounter here with Denis Kucinich, can you tell that? Because he's at a hearing and he's asking a pointed question.
Right. I mean, Congressman Denis Kucinich has been one of the few people who consistently, through the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, has been against the privatization of war. And at one of the rare congressional hearings that was held in the Republican Congress that dealt with private military contractors, Kucinich was questioning a government official. And he asks him, what happens if a contractor murders someone in Iraq? And the government official says, I don't know. And Kucinich says, well, think about what that means. That means these contractors can literally get away with murder. And that has been the case in Iraq. They've gotten away with murder. They've gotten away with torture. And to answer your question directly, Matt, about Congress, the Democrats have a plan right now. And it's aimed at oversight, and it's aimed at transparency, and it's aimed at just asking simple questions. How many contractors are there? How many have been killed? How many have been wounded? What kind of investigations are open at the Justice Department? But it falls far short of any kind of an effective system. The fact is that the only law that's on the books right now that governs contractors in Iraq would make it so that prosecutors from the U.S. would have to go over to Iraq, investigate a crime, interview witnesses, then arrest the contractor, bring them back to the United States, and prosecute them for the crime committed over there. There have been hundreds of thousands of these guys that have gone in and out of Iraq. Only one has been indicted for any kind of crime or violation, and it happened in early 2007, and he wasn't even an armed contractor. He allegedly stabbed someone in a kitchen. So there's a real problem, and unfortunately, the Democratic proposals won't get much accomplished except forcing the government to acknowledge the numbers. Because I know from the Department of Labor, because these contractors are required to have federal insurance under the Defense Base Act, it's called. So we know from the Department of Labor that 780 contractors have been killed and their families have applied for death benefits. We know that 7,600 have been wounded and have applied for injury benefits. But we don't know anything about the crimes that they've committed because no one's watching them officially.
Have any parents of some of the other 780 contractors who've been killed gotten in touch with you?
Oh, that's interesting. Yes, I have talked to a number of families from Blackwater. The Blackwater's lost about 30 guys in Iraq, and some of those families have contacted me, and a number of families from another company called DynCorp. Blackwater's actually facing another wrongful death lawsuit that's gotten almost no media attention. And it's interesting because it's not brought by the families of Blackwater mercenaries, but by the families of active duty U.S. soldiers. Blackwater has an aviation division, and they were on contract in Afghanistan with the U.S. military to ferry soldiers and equipment from one city to another inside of Afghanistan. One of those planes crashed in November of 2004, and because it was a military contract, the National Transportation Safety Board and the U.S. Army did an investigation. That's what's different about the Fallujah case. There's no official paper trail. And we got the cockpit data recordings. And the pilots were messing around. X-Wing fighters, Star Wars man, and the thing smashes into the side of a mountain. So Blackwater's being sued in Florida for the deaths of three active duty soldiers. And the judge in that case, this is being heard in federal court, has consistently rejected Blackwater's attempts to have that case thrown out. And that one actually could be the dark horse here because it's actual active duty soldiers who were killed in the aircraft of a private mercenary company.
Well, you mentioned the parallel with tobacco lawsuits. Do you think it is the courts and judges and juries that are going to be able finally to, restrain these private contractors, or will Congress ever get around to it?
The only way that that these contractors could be reined in is if it's litigated in court and effectively legislated in Congress. It has to be both of them. I mean, these lawsuits are important because I think they're going to raise awareness, and they could send shockwaves through the mercenary industry and the war industry. But unless Congress takes up, for instance, the South African model and passes an all-out anti-mercenary law, we shouldn't have a reality in this country where war is profitable. And a company like Blackwater depends on misery, suffering, violence, international conflict to make its profits. And they hire lobbyists that then try to get the politicians elected who push for these policies. They bankroll the campaigns of politicians that push for these policies. This is war profiteering at its worst. And Congress is nowhere near, even the best Democrats are not able to raise this issue in an effective way. And the Democrats that are raising it are only on the page of accountability and oversight, nowhere near banning mercenaries from operating.
It is just kind of privatization on steroids, the worst kind of privatization, if American people really understood that our government is letting mercenaries do the fighting for us. I think people would be outraged. My guest this week has been Jeremy Scahill. He's the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. It's an incredible book. I highly recommend it. Jeremy, thanks for being my guest.
Thank you, Matt, and thanks for the Progressive Magazine.
You're quite welcome.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.